through 30th at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. The Portland Eco Film Festival is the premier environmental film festival in the U.S. Pacific Northwest. This year, the festival will screen the films The Beaver Believers, Dirt Rich, The Kingdom, How Fungi Made the World, B-Sharp Honeybee, and Elephant Path. Again, that's the Portland Eco Film Festival, taking place September 27th through 30th at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. It's 9 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Hey, coming right up, we've got political perspectives today. Lisa Loving talks to peace activist Kathy Kelly. She's right here in the studio. They'll be talking about colonialism and nonviolence in the face of war. At 10 o'clock, Eric Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And then at 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock, The Recovery Zone talks to the organizers of the 2018 Radical Mycology Convergence for fungus lovers, artists, and activists. And please keep in mind that all these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. And if you'd like to become a member, you can go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Let's see if we can get some music for Lisa, and then stay tuned for her conversation with Kathy Kelly.
It's 9:01. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Today, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Yemen, finding hope in countries devastated by U.S. policy. Peace activist Kathy Kelly is in town for a series of live engagements, speaking on these news issues of the day. Kathy, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you, Lisa. I'm very pleased to be in Portland again.
These are very deep conceptual waters. These are very, very difficult issues to talk about. And yet I just feel warm all over that I'm in the room with you. Kathy Kelly, I've always admired you because I feel that for decades you have, in my experience, dedicated your life to helping the most vulnerable people that our tax money is, I want to say, killing, right? And that's not the whole story either. So Kathy Kelly, she's the co-founder of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. She has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize for her work. We were making faces about that. We'll talk about it a little bit later. Kathy is speaking in Portland tonight and tomorrow. We're going to get you that information. But I just want to start out by saying, Kathy, there's a lot of people listening right now that maybe don't know who you are. And there's so much information and noise in the world anymore. Talk about what is the work that Voices for Creative Nonviolence does. What's your mission?
Well, we're a campaign to defy and to challenge United States military and economic warfare. I guess in a way you could say most of us are pretty convinced that there can't be any rational discussion of how to solve problems in our world if we don't figure out some way to dismantle the military, because the military is scooping up the resources, the intellectual resources, the financial resources, the potential genius. It's just an insatiable, bloated, this year $717 billion budget. And what does it do? Well, what militaries have always done traditionally, destroy and kill in so many parts of the world. And I think that it's almost to a point now where militarism is like the new religion in the United States. You know, people think, well, this is our salvation. We have to protect ourselves. We have to help protect other people from threats. But the greatest threats we face right now are the threats of what we're doing to our own environment and what has been done to people who've meant us no harm whatsoever, people in Afghanistan, people today in Yemen, people today in Afghanistan, people in Iraq, people who have suffered grievously at the hands of United States military attacks and occupations and invasions. And I think it's something we have a hard time learning from because we don't learn about it. So Voices has gone over to war zones and stayed there, lived alongside people who can't escape. And one of the things we must tell ourselves is that we certainly are not perfect, and yet if we wait till we're perfect, we'll wait a very long time.
Right. We're speaking with Kathy Kelly. This is KBOO Portland. Kathy is going to be speaking tonight and tomorrow at the tonight is at 5, I think, at University of Portland. And there's also going to be a talk tomorrow night at PCC Cascade. We're going to get into some really deep discussion. So I just want to plant the seeds of you can go and listen to more of this discussion, participate in more discussion. Because Kathy, here's the other part of that. I wanted to bring this up. Over all the years that you've done this work, and you started out with another organization that you had founded, somehow this work about colonialism also impacts how we live in the United States too. And I think that maybe a lot of the focus of Voices for Creative Nonviolence is about foreign policy. I think it does something to us too as citizens. It makes us more violent. Maybe it normalizes our acceptance of violence, even amongst ourselves. I don't want to talk about that yet, but I want to flag that because Dan Handelman from Voices for Peace and Portland, and also
Peace and Justice Works,
and also Portland Cop Watch, he has also been deep in this work for many years, and he could not be here today with us because he's at the City Hall talking about police accountability, personally in my heart. These issues are linked, and it's not just Dan Handelman who has made me see that over all these years, right? There's something about when we normalize violence, and we normalize. So, I mean, I just this morning typed in the word Yemen into the New York Times, okay? And this is what the headlines say. U.S. commander urges more transparency in Yemen strike on school bus. Assault on Yemen's Al-Hudaya would be catastrophic. Saudi coalition admits error in Yemen airstrike that killed dozens. War crimes, coalitions, horror multiplies in Yemen. Hidden warnings of Yemen war. Yemen war, a living hell for children. That's our tax money. If you're listening to me now, I think it's your tax money doing that. But Kathy, I think that it also does something to us. It's like we're magnifying, I don't know, we're magnifying some, I guess I want to say capitalist, but some kind of maybe economic or socially based fear that we have built in us in the United States. And we could talk about that more, like where does this violence come from? But I want to ask you, how did you even get involved in this work in the first place? When did you get involved and what brought you to this work?
Well, I was a late bloomer. I certainly remember that at the end of the Vietnam War, almost no one that I could imagine, not in my family, not in the neighborhood, not in my part-time jobs, not at the university, no one could imagine anybody saying, oh, let's do that again. You know, when that war was over, people were ready for an end to United States foreign wars, slaughter. But the United States military and the large companies that had benefited so much from every war the United States has ever been involved in were ready to say, oh, we'll just figure out how to fix it, to fix the Vietnam syndrome. Because, maybe it might have been formerly true that you would make weapons to fight wars, but really in our recent history particularly, we've made wars to sell weapons. So that's one thing. I think people are very frightened to lose jobs, to upset the apple cart. The status quo in our country right now is that our top crop is weapons. So, I mean, you don't have to look far to find fear and greed and great pride in cultures. But when you then add weapons into the mix, then you can count on having war, oppression, and great violence. And so I think that at a fairly important time in my life, I started to realize I don't believe in these weapons. And if the mafia came to my door and said, you know, we'd like you to give us close to a third of your income, I'd probably say, well, no, I can't do that. I'm certainly not going to give it to a group that's preparing omnicide to end the world with nuclear weapons. So I became a war tax refuser. Just bang, like that. I went to the Jesuit treasurer, the school where I taught, and said, you know, can you lower my salary beneath the taxable income? And I remember he said, well, what about the IRA? And I thought he meant the Irish Republican Army. And I said, no, I'm a pacifist. And he was trying to think of some way that I could, you know, manage my elderly years with an IRA. And it was an easy decision, and I suppose the IRS has been my spiritual director ever since. But it has, Lisa, had a shaping event in my life that has been good, because you can't own anything. You can't get too involved in anything like acquiring personal wealth, and that's been good for me. I would make life too complicated if that was like something I had to think about. So there's that. But that was never enough. You know, I was dealing with young people and then eventually with young people living on the streets in Chicago and my classroom. You know, I couldn't continue to say, well, you know, maybe this war is okay, or how about that one? And I felt like more had to be done. So a number of us felt that way in the Chicago area where I lived. You know, we were involved a great deal with Soup Kitchen and Shelter and House of Hospitality, and the kids that we knew had the pencil pushers, this, you know, little storefront where they tried to sell pencils instead of drugs. Lots of good things. But we knew we could and we should do more. So I became involved in a group that planted corn on top of nuclear missile silo sites. And that got me involved in my first time going to prison, maximum security prison. And it's hard to say why, but it kind of gave me more backbone. I taught in Catholic girls' high schools long enough that, you know, being in a maximum security prison wasn't so unfamiliar, to be honest, because Catholic girls' high schools could be pretty rigid. But nothing in any of my experience had ever shown me the cruelty, the reenactment of enslavement, the onerous length of sentencing, the stigma, the kind of ongoing life consequences that the United States prison system imposes on people. And it helped me understand that this is a lifelong commitment, that I could never walk out of a prison and say, oh, well, I'm free of being part of this onerous oppression. And this, I feel the same way. I mean, why should I ever be able to return from a war zone? Because I have a blue passport? Because my skin is white? When in fact I'm part of the culture that has created this colonial oppression, and, you know, this idea that somehow one slice of the world population has a right to consume many times more than every other group in the world. So there just hasn't been any reason to question which side would you be on in terms of opposition to militarism and United States invasions and United States bloodshed, ripping apart the bodies of children or causing starvation amongst children. If anything, I guess it might sound a bit odd, but I think I've been allowed to rub shoulders with some of the kindest and most interesting people in the world, and it's often been at the other end of the United States guns.
We are speaking with Kathy Kelly. She's going to be speaking tonight and tomorrow at the University of Portland and then at Portland Community College. Kathy, I'm going to get all of my feelings. I keep doing it this week. We're seeing things happen in the United States government that I myself as an adult human being never thought I would ever see, right? Even though I would whine about it and complain and predict that the worst possible things could ever happen. As you are doing this work, you've really been focusing on, I think I want to say, what our war dollars are doing. Do you think that's an accurate statement? You've been really focusing on what's happening in, again, like some of these terms that I've always used, I don't even trust them anymore. I don't even want to say, you're talking about the War Department, you're talking about the way we bombed the Middle East. I'm not sure if that's always the case. I want you to describe for me as a reality check, How do you see your work right now and the talks that you're going to be giving tonight and tomorrow night? Why are they crucial? Why are you focusing on what you're focusing on? We'll just talk about your focus first. Let's start
first. So where you stand determines what you see. And if you live alongside people who can't escape from United States bombing, you'll see something that's different than what's seen when looking at it on a television screen or reading about it from the distance of many, many, many miles. And so after, with Voices in the Wilderness, as a means of defying the law that said that no medicines, no food, no infrastructure repair could go into the country of Iraq, we said, no, we're going to break that law. And so the way we could break the law was by breaking the economic sanctions. So we went to Iraq many, many times, Dan Handelman being very much a part of it. But people from all across the United States were forming small teams and either going to their local post office and symbolically, in a sense, trying to break the law because the post office would never send what they were trying to send to Iraq, or actually asking their relatives and friends, help me raise the airfare. I want to travel over to Jordan, and then we'll go by car and we'll cross into Iraq and deliver medicines. And it was a drop in the bucket. If we saved a life along the line because a child was dying of starvation or because they couldn't get simple antibiotics, you know, to help with a respiratory disease, well, well and good. But our primary mission in the Voices in the Wilderness was to defy the economic sanctions, to break those sanctions. And we said to the U.S. government every time we traveled, we did it again. We won't be governed by unjust laws. We were threatened with 12 years in prison, a $1 million fine, a $250,000 administrative penalty. And we said, thank you for the clarity of your warnings. We understood the penalties in the first place, but we won't be governed by unjust laws, and we invite you to join us. Well, going over to Iraq, you know, you were meeting people who were suffering desperately. Now, can you imagine if people from the United States were encountering people who came from a country that had bombed us repeatedly, wrecked our infrastructure, subjected us to siege, caused hundreds of thousands of our children to die before the age of five? Can you imagine that if people from that country came over here, we'd say, oh, can we offer you a room in our home? Can you stay with us? Can you hold our children? Can you sit down and we'll you know, share the meager meal we have with you? This was pretty stunning. So our role was to listen as best we could, knowing that we came from outside the culture that we had. We would never, ever understand more about that culture than a child selling peanuts in the corner of the marketplace. And yet, we had to also try to hear the intense fear. I mean, I remember people coming up to us saying, believe me, we are so scared. And this wasn't something the government was telling them to say as the party line. People were definitely, in the advance of the 2003 shock and awe bombing, frightened out of their wits and frightened of Saddam Hussein as well. And so we stayed there through the shock and awe bombing, and it was shocking and it was awful. And then after that, terrible, terrible trauma began to go at a time when there was tremendous displacement, when people were seeking refuge, when torture or kidnappings were occurring. It's a history that I think has been eclipsed. There's not much interest in understanding what happened under economic sanctions or during the shock and awe bombing. And so we felt like our role has been to try to keep on going back to the realities of how the U.S. militarism affects people and affects the United States, as you say. I mean, I think it's finally beginning to be understood that every day an average of 22 veterans of combat in the United States kill themselves.
We are talking with Kathy Kelly. We are talking about War and Peace. Can we say that? that we're talking about War and Peace. Kathy's going to be speaking tonight and tomorrow in Portland. These are deep conceptual waters, and I feel that as you're listening to this program, you're thinking about your own life. You're thinking about, oh, I got to go to the grocery store today, right? But I bet you're also thinking about, wow, I wonder who we bombed. I bet that, I mean, I don't know how many headlines I've seen about United States bombing weddings, right? I know part of the reason that we have a suicide epidemic for real in this country is because we see these things that are happening with our tax money, our resources on the other side of the world. Part of it is that we don't know what to do about it. And in a minute, I'm going to ask Kathy, how are we going to fix this? Kathy, I know you have answers, pockets full of answers. I do want to say, though, I want to read a press release from the 1990s. And it was written by Anne and Bruce Huntwerk. If you are, if you've been here for a few minutes, you know, rest in peace, Anne Huntwerk. There has always been a core group of, we call them raging grannies. And now it looks like I'm heading straight for that trajectory, right? Raging grannies in Portland. Women who are over retirement age have actually always been the backbone of the peace movement as long as I know. And we also had a chapter of Women in Black. Mm-hmm. who would just stand at Pi Square and just, you know, as a visual reminder. This is a fascinating community of activists that did a lot, actually. And I'm thinking of one of these activists who also did the Clothesline Project, where she took clotheslines and set them up in downtown Portland and had people write their sexual assault stories and put them up on that line. Where is she? She did this for years and no one paid attention. And now this story. You know, Kathy, I just feel like there's news every day I wake up and it's like a blizzard of, I don't know, social change, right? But anyway, U.S. imposes fines for bringing medicine and toys to Iraqi children. December 9th, 1998, right? This is a Portland press release. On December 3rd, the Office of Foreign Assets Control issued pre-penalty notices to Dan Handelman of Portland and other members of Voices in the Wilderness, stating they would be fined a total of $163,000 for, quote, exportation of donated goods, including medical supplies and toys, to Iraq, unquote. This was in the federal documents. They were charged with bringing toys. Dude, could Santa be cited? I'm putting that on the table, yo. Anyway, this stuff was a big deal. And we're talking about now we're in this environment where we've changed. We, the people, have changed. Our water is kind of boiling now, right? You've heard that analogy of, you know, if you try to stick a frog in boiling water, I'm saying, please don't try to stick a frog in boiling water. But if you try to stick a frog in boiling water, he will jump out. But if you put the frog in the water and then bring the water to a boil, the frog will boil and we'll never notice it. And a lot of people that I am with now and interacting with are wondering if we're frogs in the water. And we're getting cooked by our own society and we're not even awake or aware enough to do something about it. And so we have a young generation of activists that are active on all kinds of issues. And this is something I wanted to specifically ask you about, Kathy. Right now, Portland is very much a center of Antifa resistance, anti-fascist resistance to white supremacists. This issue of violence, right? Your organization, it's creative nonviolence, and I want to ask you about that. So now we have young people who are standing up and saying, no, I'm going to be violent if someone comes to me with violence. Is it okay to punch a Nazi is an issue that people debate in the public square. I want to be really vague. I just spent time with people who were involved in a revolutionary movement in Central America. And these people were describing, they had gotten together for a reunion, and they were describing how the people who were violent are the people who suffered the most, because somehow the violence that those people inflicted on other people reverbed on them and did something to their heads. Mm-hmm. This conversation that I sat in on, listening to these actual armed revolutionaries, and I'm going to be super vague about it, this blew my mind. It hadn't even occurred to me. And that's why I'm bringing it to you like this, Kathy. Like, we're talking about what's happening far away, but it's something we're doing to our own selves. So do you ever hear this debate about, is it okay to punch a Nazi? Or, you know, the modern, like, young people today who are demanding the right to be violent, like, in the streets here against people that they oppose. I mean, do you ever hear that debate?
Well, I think, sure. I think the means we use, though, as you suggest, will determine the end we get. The means you use determines the end you get. I think about the white supremacist bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church. I think we were at the 55th year since that happened. And as a response, not an immediate response, but it had happened in September, Ossie Davis, Louis Lomax, Ruby Dee, and James Baldwin had put together what they called the Christmas boycott. They said when bombing and destruction becomes so normalized, we can't afford Christmas. And so they asked people to boycott Christmas that year. And that, I think, was a very wise way to kind of make people stop and take stock and not be so consumed in the violent system that they would begin to think the violence is normal. I sometimes regret that we ever changed our name from Voices in the Wilderness, which is what we were, in terms like a wilderness of compassion here in the United States, to Voices for Creative Nonviolence, because we never feel like it's our role to teach nonviolence to someone else, but rather to try to understand the violence that the United States has inflicted mm-hmm. on other people and say we want to create something different. We want to live something different. And that requires that we look at our lifestyles and try to think, okay, we aren't going to survive. It's not sustainable the way we are. How can we live more simply, share resources more radically, mm-hmm. and prefer to be in a relationship to others where we're not perpetuating domination and colonial grabbing? And I think if we ask ourselves, well, why is the United States so perpetually at war? Why do we live in a permanent warfare state? It has to do with satiating the greed of the major weapon makers here. I'm thinking about Raytheon and General Dynamics and Lockheed and Boeing. And then when we ask ourselves, so why are the Saudis even bombing Yemen in the first place? I think it's a land grab. They want to bludgeon Yemeni people into submission so that they can take Yemen's resources. Well, why should the United States be supporting that? And it all goes into this sort of nasty, cruel circle of avaricious people who think that there is such a thing as royal blood, or there is such a thing as the 1% deserving a massive share of the pie and needing big arsenals of weapons to protect that capacity. So our job is to say this doesn't make us safe. Our social security, our safety is predicated on extending a hand of fairness. And in a fair system, you don't say that some children don't deserve to live. So our solutions, I think, are kind of homegrown. They're nowhere near the scale of what the military and all of its minions accomplish. But for instance, we'll be in New York City November 6th, 7th, 8th. November 6th is Election Day, a very important day, but some of us will vote early and go off to New York City. And in front of the U.S. mission to the U.N., the Saudi mission to the U.N., and the United Arab Emirates mission to the UN will set up 34 bright blue children's backpacks. Because we want to say those children were excited. They were just on a field trip. They were on a school bus in Yemen. And they were selected to be hit with a 500-pound laser-guided bomb manufactured by Lockheed Martin because the Saudis want, and the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman said this. He said, I want future generations of people in Yemen to shiver when they hear the word Saudi Arabia. And the United States has said, well, okay, we'll ask you to be a little more careful. But Pompeo and Mattis, the Secretary of State, and the Secretary of Defense went over to Saudi Arabia, took a look, and came back and said, yeah, we can certify. They're really trying to improve their targeting when they drop and fire these bombs. Well, who is the United States to even be asked to make such a decision? We bombed a Doctors Without Borders hospital in Afghanistan, and for an hour, even after the people in Afghanistan were notifying NATO, they were notifying the United States, they were notifying the United Nations, this is a hospital, you're bombing a hospital. The United States C-113 transport plane with Bofors cannons and huge arsenals of guns, and they circled around, came back, bombed again on 15-minute intervals until the hospital, emergency room, and ICU department were reduced to rubble. That was October 5th, 2016. By the end of the month in 2016, the Saudis did the same thing. And when Ban Ki-moon, then Secretary General of the United Nations, said to Saudi Arabia, you know, you really can't just be bombing hospitals, tongue-in-cheek, the brigadier general in charge in Saudi Arabia that had just bombed the hospital in Yemen, a Doctors Without Borders hospital in Yemen, said, well, we'll ask our American counterparts for more advice about targeting. So you see the relationship. The United States does it. Green lights, bombing hospitals. And this has happened again and again and again. With Guantanamo, we green light torture. And then you look at the news that, of course, is so overwhelming, and you say people are being tortured in detention centers, tortured by the United Arab Emirates, tortured by Saudi people, tortured by Yemeni. Well, who are the people who have said, well, that's okay to do in terms of American exceptionalism? We've maintained Guantanamo for all these years. And then, you know, our history of wars and invasions and selling weapons has said to people all around the world, this is acceptable. Now, we want to say, well, it's only acceptable if we're doing it, and if we say somebody else is wrong. But it's a hypocrisy and a greed and a level of corruption that simply ought never be sustained.
Excellent. So we are speaking with Kathy Kelly. These are deep conceptual waters, and my mind is fracturing into all these different directions as you're describing the military-industrial complex, basically, and how it works. I mean, why couldn't Barack Obama close Guantanamo? That was one of his biggest campaign promises, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
Can you answer that? Why couldn't he close it? I mean, I'm not putting you... I would have loved to put you in charge.
I think that if Barack Obama had said, you know what, that second term isn't as important as saving lives and limbs, it would have, in terms of his integrity as a person of great, great value to the United States and the world, it would have been better to forego getting that second term. But had he taken on the military-industrial complex and the prison-industrial complex, he quite likely would not have been elected for that second term. And so, you know, I'm sure people would be saying, so maybe we would have gotten Trump a little sooner. And to me, the responsibility of people in our everyday life is to vote with our feet every day. Certainly go out November 6th and vote, but we have to figure out on an everyday basis how we're going to say to enormous powers, we don't want to be acting like big children, distracted by sports and entertainment and, you know, mesmerized by situations we feel we can't be involved in. We have to take that adult responsibility on an everyday basis to pay very close attention to the world around us and figure out what it is that we can do. And we each, I believe, can escalate, given the tremendous vulnerability of our world today, we can escalate the level of our involvement in trying to grapple with the greatest terrors we face, the terror of what we're doing to our own environment and the terror inflicted by the militarism that we've bought and paid for.
We are live in Studio 2 with Kathy Kelly. This hour is going to stick with me for a long time, Kathy. I have some questions about our society that I feel like people who have been here for a few minutes, maybe we can talk about like why things are the way they are. But I do feel that people who have made vows of poverty, I'm gonna put that out. You've made a vow to live your life in a simple way and to put yourself out there to make this social change happen. And I meet so many people now who want to make social change happen, but we don't know how, right? As you said, well, the winners, the victors write the history. So as we talk about all the people who are being active, all the people who, there might even, you know, all the political prisoners in the United States right now. Most people, we couldn't name many, because that's not something the New York Times covers. That's not something the Washington Post or the Associated Press or the Oregonian doesn't come out once a year and list all the political prisons in the penitentiary at Sheridan right now. You know, it's interesting when you look at how much information's out there. But how hard it can be to get it.
Well, I mean, right now, 7 activists who've been my lifelong friends are in prison in Kings Bay, Georgia, because they were deeply motivated by the belief that you shouldn't accept nuclear weapons. And they're part of this tradition that says, in fact, go back 2,500 years and listen to the prophets of old who said, beat your swords into plowshares.
The plowshares movement, I was going to say.
Pruning hooks, yeah. So they're facing a long time in prison. But it's an interesting time also because the Trump administration very much wanted passage of a Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which meant they could set up Christmas trees and plazas and public places. They could have, prayers said at football games. They didn't really plan on 7 very devout Catholic worker activists who spent their lives trying to share resources and make sure that people who otherwise might be literally falling through the cracks, left out in the cold, would have a place to be. People who are the first ones you'd call if you wanted to say, could we try assembling a peace team in the face of this war? They're now saying we were acting in accord with our religious devout beliefs. And because the judge and the magistrates and the lawyers for the prosecution aren't quite sure what to do with this, the trial has been delayed and delayed. They took their action on April 4th, deliberately timed to coincide with the anniversary of the assassination of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. And they said, you know, one of the greatest instances of white supremacy in our time is our nuclear arsenal that's aimed at the entire world. And so the trial has been delayed because the powers that be, I think, are not quite sure what to do with this claim that they were acting in accord with their religious freedom. So I think we can all of us say, no matter what your faith belief, or if you don't have any particular faith belief, we can all say, I have a right not to kill. I'm going to claim my right not to kill, and not to be told by a higher power in the United States that they can commandeer my resources to kill other people. And basically, you know, the United States military and to some extent the State Department, they don't want our advice. They don't really want our assent. They want our money. And I don't think it's very easy for very many people to be involved in war tax refusal, but we can be involved in levels of non-cooperation. And I think all of the communities that are doing environmental work, that are working on mass incarceration, on immigration issues, on homelessness issues, I think all of these different groups are living out the vision of what they want to be. But I would say, again, repetitively, there can be no rational discussion of solving the problems we face if we don't tackle the gorilla sitting in the middle of the room, the United States military, which is sucking up the resources like a demonic suction cup. And that's quoting Dr. Martin Luther King.
Demonic suction cup. I'm writing that one down too. Demonic suction cup. Kathy, ever since Donald J. Trump was elected president, a lot of us have become more upended than we thought would be possible, right? I have really big questions about how the electoral system works. I really question the value of Democrat and Republican party labels. I question the machines, the political machines. You know what? It's the political machines that worry me. As you move through the world right now, do you feel that times are different now? Do you think that the election of that guy changed things? Or do you think that it's just another overlay and we're still struggling the way we were and we need to just double down?
Well, I think we have a very erratic and unpredictable and undereducated person in the White House. There's no doubt about that. But I suppose I I want to get past that eclipse of the hundreds of thousands of children in Iraq who died as a direct result of economic sanctions. That happened under successive presidencies. And again, not at first, you know, the United Nations was saying, look, you know, thousands of children are dying. And then they said tens of thousands, just children under age five, tens of thousands are dying. And then they said they believed that it could be as many as 500,000 children under age five dying as a direct result of United States policy. Now, that was under the Clintons, that was under Bush. So I don't think that this is something new. The mask that past presidents' administrations could wear was much easier to look at than President Trump and the people he surrounds himself with. The mask is kind of torn off. I mean, Trump doesn't have a mask. But the capacity of the United States to act as a menacing, bullying force in the world has been consistent and steady and unrelenting. Now, that isn't to say that average ordinary people in the United States are cruel or vicious, but we have been asleep at the wheel in many, many ways by not insisting that the United States military be reined in and subjected to analysis. I mean, I think if you look at the heads of universities and the people in secure places in universities, if you look at the heads of faith-based communities and people in secure places in faith-based communities, if you look at people who've had, pretty significant leadership roles, I don't think there's been anything close to the challenge to Lockheed and Boeing and General Dynamics and Raytheon that we need to make in order to say we don't want to be under the thrall of a mafiosa-like weapon-making group that has a vice-like grip on United States education. We have to educate ourselves.
And see, you just said that. That's part of what fascinates me. We used to, years ago, talk about the butterfly effect. I'm not sure if anyone ever talks about that anymore. It's kind of a concept, a theoretical concept, mm-hmm. that something could happen on one side of the world, something really small, like a butterfly wiggling their wings, and it could lead to a hurricane on the other side of the world. And you'll see that as an analogy that's brought out in all kinds of different ways. But I'm so curious now, because I have been in too many news stories, too many newsrooms, and a lot of these corporate names are scrambled in my head. And then we'll start talking about the prison industrial complex. Then we'll start talking about the military industrial complex, and I get super confused. And
well, no need to, because General Dynamics is in both of them.
And see, and now you had mentioned that you had been a teacher in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that a little bit? How is our local community violence linked to these international bombings? I want to say it like that. I feel it instinctually. But am I wrong? I mean, what is your take on that? Is there a connection?
Well, I think that there are gun-making groups, weapon sellers in Chicago who have no compunction about continuing to make sure that they profit from weapons being available. And there's desperation, tremendous desperation in neighborhoods in Chicago, and people have been neglected. There's no job industry, and so people turn to the one industry that does seem to provide an income, and that often does have to do with the drug trade. And then
organized crime.
And so I think it would require a great deal of investment to be able to overcome the neglect and the cruelty that's been shown to the most impoverished residents of neighborhoods in Chicago. But we could do it. It's not an unthinkable task, but we can't do it and still continue to bankroll the $717 billion military budget. I can say the same thing in Afghanistan. I mean, I've been fortunate to be taught by teenagers in Afghanistan who've never, they've never lived with a television. They haven't been schooled in the desire to imitate the United States wealth or violence. In fact, they say blood doesn't wash away blood, and they don't want anything to do with warlords of any sort. They just happen to know that the United States is the most well-heeled and the most dangerous of all the warlords affecting their lives. But I see in these youngsters what I call surveillance. They engage in surveillance. They have spiral notebooks and pencils, and they go up the mountainsides, and that in itself is no easy trek. You know, we're talking about sometimes in icy cold winters, and they go in and sit down with the widows who don't have anyone to bring in an income, and they start to ask questions. How often does your family eat beans in a week? And what's your access to water? And who earns an income? And if the person who earns the income is under 12 years of age, and if the widow is saying we survive on the scraps of potatoes and turnips when our children go down to the marketplace at the bottom of the mountain, and we don't have water unless we pay for it, then they put those surveys at the top of their deck that they've collected after they've gone to visit and ask all these survey questions. And then they figure out, how can we rearrange whatever resources we can get our hands on so that the children can start to get educated and the women can get enough livelihood? And Eureka, they came up with it. They said, you know, let us help the women get the materials to make the heavy blankets, and then we'll distribute them free of charge amongst the most desperate people in the refugee camps. Let us help these kids come and become at least literate and stay out of human trafficking, quite frankly. And then we'll make sure that their families get beans and cooking oil and rice every month. I mean, it's so practical. It's so hands-on. It's so everyday. Now, you know, the money comes from generous people in Portland and Chicago and New York and other places. And it's just a drop in the bucket compared to the need, and certainly compared to what the United States is pouring into maintenance of our military operations there. Scandalous figures of money that's been squandered in Afghanistan. But these kids take the small amounts that we're able to bring over there, and they practice sharing, and they extend, it ripples out. Right now they're having an inter-province, inter-ethnic gathering in a country where 21 out of 34 provinces are suffering from drought. These kids, youngsters, teenagers, are coming together and trying to figure out, how can we live more decently? Well, we could do that here.
And we do. We actually do it here. So it's just like the question is, how do we...
Well, unpack from the television.
How do we make it systematically, right? How do we do it systematically? And the other thing is those phones, right? Mm-hmm. You know, J.R.R.R. Tolkien, I'm not really the biggest fan. I've got issues there. But his whole trip about people with magical bowling balls that they keep in their closet, and that's Saruman, and it drives them crazy. Those cell phones are like that. They're like something out of, you know, blah, 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 The Rings. There's something about those cell phones that make us not all that we could be. And I was reading the suicide rate amongst teenage girls started going up when cell phones became a consumer item. And it is a big row. And, you know, we have a suicide epidemic in this country. Mm-hmm. I only ever really read stories about it in the New York Times, I think. And they have exhaustive stories. And that's another thing I see people, you know, hand to hand, bucket brigade helping with, is people's mental health. People are trying to bucket brigade mental health in the United States, right? And I do hear some people on different levels saying, no, you're setting up death councils or something. Well, people are dying in the hospital already. We don't need councils to do that. But I just wish that we could do basic stuff, Kathy. And again, like, I just realized I qualified for the senior citizens discount at Denny's, right? At my last birthday. And it really made me stop and think about life. It really did. And I, there are so many curtains, Kathy. It's easy for us to choose to hide behind them. But now we're kind of raising our children behind them. And our children are just as resourceful as all the other kids. And it worries me about the kids. It worries me about the kids. I want to break in here and say, Coming up this morning on KBOO at 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, The Recovery Zone. This is such a great show. Talks to the organizers of the Radical Mycology Convergence for fungi lovers, artists, and activists. I bet there's a lot of fun guys on that show. Hey, and thank you so much for helping us with our membership drive. If you're listening right now, you did that. And you're doing all of this, honestly. I'm sitting here. I'm a volunteer. I'm in Studio 2 with Kathy Kelly. We're talking about really important, these are the deep issues of the day. But I do want to say, if you did call us up during that membership drive, you are radioactive, and I love you. So, Kathy Kelly, she's in town. She is going to be speaking Wednesday, September 26th. That is today, starting at 5 at Shiley Hall 319. That's at the University of Portland, I believe. And then tomorrow, going to be speaking at 7 p.m. at the Moriarty Arts Building Auditorium at PCC Cascade. That's on North Killingsworth, an incredible facility. It's interesting. I just said PCC Cascade. Now, the community college system serves more students than any other system in the state of Oregon. It's beloved. It is used so much that the wheels are coming off, right? Mm-hmm. So our state invests in that. And it's great, but we're not so well educated in this country. In Oregon, we don't even graduate from high school, right? Actually, our high school completion rates are very bad. We don't all know how to read, Kathy. So that's not something I thought I'd ever see in my lifetime. I thought literacy would grow, right, in my mm-hmm. lifetime, but it's actually illiteracy has grown. I want to ask you, in our last 10 minutes, I'd really like to tap on some of your wisdom as an activist and an organizer, because I know there's people out here that are looking at issues that you and I probably haven't thought of yet, because that's the nature of humans. So for people, I have one of my favorite activists in the whole world is in this room with me. What advice would you give to some of the people, young and old, who are listening right now, and they're looking at some really hard issue and it's beating them down? What should they do? How do they organize, Kathy? How do they start?
I think it's important to find kindred spirits. You know, everybody feels fear. I think courage is the ability to control our fears. And then find other people who are, you know, maybe not necessarily the people that you'd choose to socialize with, even maybe you don't even necessarily like these people, but people who are kindred spirits, who share with you a particular concern. And I also think it's important to make sure that we've got one foot firmly planted, each of us, amongst those who are bearing the brunt of whatever that concern is. And then one foot firmly planted amongst people who are trying to resist whatever oppression is resulting from that concern. And then if you find kindred spirits, it becomes more likely that you can rise. If you spread the peanut butter too thin, the bread rips. We can't take on every issue. I do believe that we have to address the militarism in our country. I think it has become, through militarization, a new religion, and that other faith expressions are almost like a smokescreen sometimes that cover up this very extensive and growing pervasiveness of militarization in our culture. So I can't myself let go of that. I really feel that needs to be said. But I also want people to give themselves a pat on the back every morning when they wake up and recognize that each of us has, in no doubt, been in our own ways trying to create a better world, to build a world wherein it's easier to be good. That was the formula that Dorothy Day and Peter Warren used in getting the Catholic Worker going. So, you know, it is important to know where the places in our city are where people are most likely to, as I might sometimes say, fall through the cracks or not have enough to eat or not have enough shelter or be at risk of being scooped up by immigration, ICE. I mean, it's good to have that geography in our mind. And then where does our allegiance go? Do you want to pay allegiance to, support for the people who perpetuate that kind of suffering and anxiety, or find ways to build that new world kind of within the shell of the old. And these are things that so many people long for and crave for, and we're just like a tiny fraction of the world's population. You might feel sort of isolated, like, you know, we're David and Goliath. But if we look at the world population, there are many, many millions of people who want exactly that vision of a world wherein people can be safe to live. And as long as weapons are the obstacle between ourselves and the vision we'd like to have, then other people will also be suffering from the results of those explosions, those missiles tearing into houses, the emergency rooms filling up.
Slow starvation of entire countries.
State of siege, yeah.
Yeah.
So I think we do have to deal with the weapons. But again, I want to take that formula that my friends that are in prison right now are facing trial for the Plowshares action take. And basically what they're saying is that when you have fear and pride and greed and combine that with weapons, you end up with hatred and violence and war. The weapons become such a huge obstacle. So I'm all for disarming ourselves.
And it's interesting to me, too, when you put it that way, when you pose the equation that way, because I walk down the street of my town and I wonder, why are there thousands of people living in the street? Where is the money going? I could see where there is money, and then I can see where there is not money. But I don't even feel like it's the whole picture. And when you look at the militarization, our military industrial system, $717 billion, you said, like, I can't wrap my brain around that. All of our local municipalities are always starving for money for services. In Oregon, we don't even have services for mental health, right? Mm. The big Veterans Administration scandal over the past decade has been not enough resources for mental health, or the mental health resources aren't being given to the soldiers. And so when we're talking about the suicide epidemic in the United States, the suicide epidemic of soldiers is crushing. It's soul crushing for a human being to even think about that. More soldiers have died by their own hand than in the wars, right? So it's like, when you say we have to look at the militarism, you're saying militarism, and I see everything that the militarism is triggering is probably the unfortunate word for that. So it's like, when I look around and I walk down the street, I see what we're not investing in. We don't even talk about best practices in the schools. We never talk. If we fully funded the schools in the United States of America, it would be the most incredible jobs creation program, wouldn't it be? We don't even talk about that. We would never even consider doing that, but cut the military budget. And like you said, it's its own religion.
So what do we really need? We need to emphasize alternative forms of energy, means of transportation that would make sense, like, you know, bullet speed trains would be a great idea in many places. We need to retrofit the housing stock. We need to think about elder care. We need to think about child care. I mean, people know what we need. We don't need huge weapons systems and new nuclear weapons in order to have a better life or a better world. But the major weapon-making corporations do not want you to think that way. And they are able to influence so many forms of education through media, through owning congresspeople, through their massive lobbying potential.
I want to buy a member of Congress. I want a lawmaker. I want to buy one. Okay, we're running out of show. So I want to give people the information on how to participate with you. So tonight, Kathy Kelly, she speaks 5 to 7:30 p.m. at Shiley Hall, 319. That's at the University of Portland, of Intervention Immigration on the U.S. Then tomorrow, that's Thursday, Kathy at 7 p.m. is at the Moriarty Arts Building Auditorium at PCC Cascade. That's on North Killingsworth. She's going to be talking about Afghanistan, Iraq, and Yemen, finding hope in countries devastated by U.S. policy. Kathy, where do people find you? What if people say, I love her and I just want to give her all my money? How do they do it?
Well, we would love to have people join with us in various actions. And we live in Chicago, on the north side of Chicago. The website is, I'm going to say the initials are hard to get straight. But VCNV.org, it's the acronym for Voices for Creative Nonviolence. VCNV.org. And for me, my email is Kathy@VCNV.org. It's pretty easy to find us if you just type Voices for Creative Nonviolence or my name and that into a website. And we're, you know, we're very, very pleased to be in touch with people. I mean, KBOO has been great in contacting us and sometimes notifying us about problems that we should be paying more attention to. We're so grateful for Peace and Justice Works and Dan Handelman. We're grateful to Michael and Chris Sunlightner, whom I've known for years, who have been at the heart of many, many activist struggles here in Portland. And we need to listen to and learn from your activists here, too.
Please do. Listen up, people. Thank you so much for tuning in. This has been Political Perspectives. Our guest, Kathy Kelly, Demonic Suction Cups. Now, that's not leaving my mind for a few minutes. And you're listening to KBOO Portland. Please stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Kathy Kelly, co-founder of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, on Thursday, September 27th at 7 p.m. at PCC Cascade in Portland. Kathy will speak on Afghanistan, Iraq, and Yemen, finding hope in countries devastated by U.S. policy. Her particular focus helps expose the direct impacts of U.S. policies, including sanctions, war, drones, and military support for warring parties. Again, that's Kathy Kelly, co-founder of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, on Thursday, September 27th at 7 p.m. at Moriarty Arts Building Auditorium at PCC Cascade, 705 North Killingsworth in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's 10:01. It's time now for Air Cascadia here on KBOO, KBOO Portland. Coming up at 10:15, it's Flashpoints, and then at 11, we've got the Recovery Zone, all coming up on your community radio station where you can become a member.